It's 2 o'clock, and this is Captain Rick reporting. I'll be reading from the Wednesday, July 11th edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. The first article is entitled, The No-Spin Zone, A New Wind Energy Battle is Taking Root in DeWitt County, by Kevin Barlow. Wapella. Every year, on the 4th of July, Brooke Cooper and her family head to a pasture on their rural property east of Wapella, aim their lawn chairs to the southeast, and wait for dusk to fall and the fireworks show from Clinton to begin. This year, while the slight line remained unobstructed, red blinking lights from the Ranford's Run wind farm near Maroa hampered their view. It was awful, she said. All we could see was a sea of red blinking lights from those towers. Also, it served as a reminder that a proposed wind farm could someday block that view, but for Cooper, that is only part of the problem. I am concerned about the medical issues for my son, who has been diagnosed with ADHD, severe 1 bipolar, and has Asperger's syndrome, she said. Little things that wouldn't affect others might affect him. Tradewind Energy, developer of the proposed Alta Farms 2 wind farm, has not yet applied for the special use permit necessary to build turbines in DeWitt County. Preliminary plans indicate that the turbines would be placed in a footprint from Waynesville to Wapella. In one proposal, Cooper said, places a turbine 1,800 feet north of their home. I bought these few acres of paradise to raise my family on and retire on, she said. I feel like that's not a guarantee anymore. Cooper is among an active group of DeWitt County residents opposing the wind farm, which would be the first in the county, before the review process has even begun. The final decision will be left to the DeWitt County Board, following hearings before the Regional Planning Commission and Zoning Board of Appeals. Tom Schwarzewski, a development director with Tradewind, said the company anticipated applying for the permit in late spring, but thinks the final application should be completed soon. This is DeWitt County's first wind farm application, and so we want to make sure that we are comfortable processing our application, he said. It is taking a little bit longer than we would have liked, but it is still on schedule. We feel like we have a lot of community support and believe the project will be under construction sometime next year, so it can be up and running sometime in 2020. Frank Black, a retired union laborer from rural Waynesville, is on board, saying, a wind farm could bring in more money and more jobs. Logan and Macon counties did it. It's our turn now. Similar projects have popped up across Illinois in recent years. The Bishop Hill 3 wind farm between Moline and Peoria began operating in May. More turbines are planned in Knox County. The Ranford's Run project, which includes 139 turbines, began churning power in December, relaying electricity for a grid across 13 states. It is the biggest single-phase wind farm built in Illinois and largest wind farm built in the U.S. last year, with a projected revenue of $6.1 million in property taxes over the next 30 years. 36 landowners filed a lawsuit in December 2015 against developers EON and members of the Macon County Board to stop the project. They raised concerns about possible medical problems and pointed to reports that shadow flickers and ultrasound emissions from the device can cause health issues. Groups like American Wind Energy Association Say the industry supports numerous jobs in building and maintaining the equipment, a key source of clean energy. A map by the Trade Association shows projects in a wide belt across the central and northern parts of the state, from the 67-turbine rail splitter wind farm in Logan and Tazewell counties to the 94-unit Pioneer Trail wind farm in Ford and Iroquois counties. Some of the largest concentrations nationally are in Iowa, Minnesota, and Texas. Opponents of the DeWitt development, such as Andrea Rhodes of rural Kinney, vow to fight the project, airing concerns heard in other central Illinois wind farm cases: the potential of reduced property values of homes near turbines, health-related issues, and noise, among others. Also falling short of getting the county to place a moratorium on wind farms, Rhodes and others are hoping to convince the county board to pass a series of ordinance changes designed to protect residents located in the wind farm's path. On Monday, the Zoning Board of Appeals will consider 6 proposed revisions for recommendation to the full board. Approval could be later this month, prior to submission of a special use application from the company. Several neighbors and other DeWitt County residents think those proposed changes would help residents, whether they live near the proposed turbines or not, said Clinton resident Christina Deerwester. I have severe chronic migraine, she said. This condition is made worse by flickering or flashing of light, as well as noise levels. I'm sure there are others who live within the area of the proposed farm who have issues with their health related to the same things I struggle with. I have no argument to the farm as long as measures are put in place to limit those disturbances. Setbacks, noise insulation, aircraft controls to allow the flashing lights to be limited, etc., are all reasonable restrictions to allow anyone to use and enjoy their property as they see fit. Several residents oppose the wind farm, including Rhodes, plan to speak at the Zoning Board of Appeals meeting. Zoning ordinances are in place to ensure that property owners can use their land as they wish, as long as they don't disrupt their neighbor's ability to do the same, she said. That's what we are fighting for. Lease owner agreements are confidential and often vary quite a bit. Several potential lease owners declined comment, but DeWitt County resident Alice Aber said there was more to wind farms than just money for the property owners. On the short term, the local wind farms will provide jobs, additional income for local farmers who allow them on their land and be taking a huge step in preparing for the future, she said. The technology in wind turbines has advanced dramatically in the last 5 years or so, and now they run much more efficiently. DeWitt County Board Chairman David Newberg said board members have already heard from both sides of the issue and are preparing to make an informed decision once the special use permit is finalized. The next article is about Macon County government. Scott faces second federal lawsuit. 2 former employees allege they were wrongfully terminated. By Allison Petty. Decatur. 2 former employees filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday against Macon County and State's Attorney J. Scott, alleging that they were wrongfully terminated after they reported misconduct. It's the second legal action against Scott by a former worker in the past 2 months. In a 25-page complaint, Robin Lewis and Leah Cohn said they were let go from their jobs in July 2016 in retaliation for reporting that employees were working on Scott's re-election campaign during office hours. County officials cited budget cuts as the reason, but the women say this was an excuse. Scott said Tuesday evening that he was aware of the lawsuit, but didn't want to comment on the pending legal action. He had previously denied allegations of misconduct made by Lewis and others. This other federal lawsuit was filed May 22nd by Amanda Maxwell Berger, the former personnel director for the office. Berger said she was wrongfully fired after she reported violations of state law and county policies. That lawsuit is pending. Lewis had worked for Macon County since October 1994 and was a domestic violence coordinator and victim advocate at the time of her termination. Cohn had worked for the county since 1997 and was a deferred prosecution coordinator when she was let go. They were asking the court to give them back their jobs with back pay, employee and pension benefits, or to pay them for salaries and benefits that they would have earned if they were still employed. Both said they were exposed to a hostile work environment and that Macon County Chairman Jay Dunn and other county board members knew or should have known about those conditions. Dunn did not immediately respond to a message seeking comment Tuesday evening. The women said they told supervisors that Scott and others were violating state law that protects workers from discrimination and harassment, and also violating provisions of the county's employee handbook with political activity in the workplace. Greg Mattingly, then chairman of the board's Justice Committee, and other senior managers confronted Scott about the allegations on July 7, 2016, the women said. Their employment was terminated the same day. Mattingly declined to comment when reached by phone Tuesday evening. The lawsuit comes after a lengthy investigation into allegations of misconduct against Scott, starting in September 2016, when Mattingly and attorney John Davis sought a special prosecutor to look into Scott's behavior. Scott said in court documents that he claims against him were politically motivated. At the time, he was in the midst of a heated campaign as he prepared to face Republican Dan Hassinger in the November election. Scott defeated Hassinger to win a second term. Berger and Lewis both filed affidavits in support of the special prosecutor, detailing several instances in which they said Scott acted inappropriately. These included an incident in which they said an employee and a victim's family members were expected to view evidence for a pending aggregated DUI case and instead saw a pornographic video. Scott was also accused of asking employees to shuttle his children in county-owned vehicles. Bloomington attorney Stephen Wong was appointed to act as a special prosecutor after months of consideration. She decided in February not to pursue criminal charges against Scott, but did make public a grand jury's report that called the office work environment toxic and threatening. Scott, in turn, denounced the grand jury report as slanderous and unlawful. Tony Reed of the Herald and Review contributed to this story. Decatur Celebration admission to double for this year's event. Organizers cite continuing financial shortfalls for MOVE. By Danette Beckett. Decatur. Decatur Celebration organizers say a continued financial shortfall drove them to double the price of admission to the three-day downtown festival planned August 3rd through 5th. This is the second year admission has been charged. "We are trying to stay alive," said Jeff Ludwick, president of the Decatur Celebration Board. "Last year, we didn't make money. We didn't even break even." General admission tickets are $10 to buy online this year, plus a $2 service fee per ticket. They'll be sold at local businesses and officials hope to have that information available next week. Details will be announced on the Decatur Celebration Facebook page and at DecaturCelebration.com. Purchases at the gate will be $15. Children 12 and younger are free. VIP packages this year range from $50 to $150. Wristbands to last year's event cost $5 in advance and $8 at the gate. This year's lineup includes country artist Gretchen Wilson, rapper T.I., and rock band Daughtry. The Christian artists Crowder and Jonathan McReynolds are also playing, as well as various regional bands, 60 food items, 3 blocks of acts and crafts, a wine and beer garden, and a kids block are also returning. The event also supports numerous nonprofit organizations that work during the weekend. Entry to Decatur Celebration for 32 years was free, but officials in April 2017 said they would start charging admission and install a fence around the festival site to provide financial help. Advanced sales of wristbands last year began on May 15th. The Herald and Review last month reported the 2017 festival made $960,000 in admission fees, commissions, sponsorships, and fundraising. The event also cost $964,000 to produce, according to the financial records obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request to the City of Decatur, which has provided police and public works employees at an estimated cost of $70,000. The city raised concerns about ongoing financial support because of a $3.2 million budget deficit. The financials show Decatur Celebration has had 6 years of operating losses. Ludwig said one of the largest struggles for the celebration organizers is providing quality attractions. The cost of the acts keep going up, he said. We are trying to put up a good lineup for Central Illinois. Acts over the years have included Rick Springfield, Nelly, Vanilla Ice, Night Ranger, Charlie Daniels Band, and Joan Jett. Organizers in June said the carnival will also require admission. In the past, the not-for-profit event relied on major corporations for support. They aren't giving us much, Ludwig said. So it is getting passed down to the individuals. They also organize fundraisers like the 5th annual Decatur Celebration Boat Poker Run held on Sunday at Lake Decatur. Celebration producer Laurie Sturgill, they've seen a positive response to this year's lineup, especially in the Christian acts. She said the wristband cost is worth it. It is still a nominal fee with the caliber of artists we have, she said. An estimated 30,000 attended the 2017 celebration, according to documents submitted to the city. The next article is about public art. Law firm honors Lincoln's legacy with new mural. Law firm commissions work which features famous quote. By Claire Hettinger. Decatur. A downtown law firm is paying homage to the most famous attorney to practice in Central Illinois, not to mention the country's 16th president. Artist Eric Weatherford is reproducing a portrait of Abraham Lincoln on the side of the building at 234 South Franklin Street as a commission for Brown, Hawkins, and Basola. The mural also features the last line of Lincoln's most famous speech, the Gettysburg Address. Quote, "And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Weatherford, a Decatur native and Millikan University graduate, takes commissions for both interior and exterior artwork through his business, Odd Wall Painting. Recent creations include murals at Donnie's Homespun Pizza on Oakland Avenue and Miracle Valley Plaza at the corner of Wood and Mattiff Streets. "This is Waterford's first attempt at a portrait," he said. "His process resembles a paint-by-numbers kit," he said. "This is all new to me," he said. "I am kind of stoked about it." For the Lincoln mural, Weatherford projected an image of the portrait onto the wall, filled in the outline with primer, and traced each individual shape to be filled in with different colors. "I broke down the portrait into a language I would understand," he said, "and it seems to be working out." The piece is the latest addition to a growing public art movement in the city. The Decatur Area Arts Council's mural project has led to a range of pieces since it began in 2013, and now businesses are commissioning their own. I'm going to describe a picture in the paper. There's a Scoville Park employee squatted down holding about a 3-foot alligator. To his left is a little girl in a green dress pulling on her blonde hair, smiling and looking at the alligator's head. To his right is a little girl standing next to him, looking tentatively at the alligator's back. To her right is a little boy squatted down with his left arm out on the alligator's back. The article reads, the caption under the article reads, "Zoo Buddies, Mason Webb 4 left, Reeve Brummett 3 middle, and Hannah Brocht 3 observe a live alligator held by education and volunteer coordinator Ben Rapson as he talks to kids about animals that eat fish during the Zoo Buddies program at the Zoville Zoo Tuesday morning. The zoo hosts the program on the first Tuesday of each month. Children will get the opportunity to learn about and do activities related to rainforests at the next Zoo Buddies gathering in August." Next is a very timely article in light of what happened recently with the soccer team in the cave in Thailand. The article is entitled, "Exploring Illinois, Missouri Caves Can Be Hazardous. Experts Offer Safety Reminder in Wake of Thailand Rescue," by Derek Holtman of the Belleville News Democrat. 2 weeks into the efforts to rescue a young soccer team in Thailand, area cave experts are stressing the importance of cave safety in southern Illinois. In the case of the cave in Thailand, the kids have been fortunate to be in a warmer climate that would not necessarily work out so well in this area, said Dan Lamping, board member of the Illinois Speleological Survey and president of the Missouri Speleological Survey. Caves in southern Illinois are typically around 58 degrees. Not moving around, hypothermia could set in fairly quickly, especially when one is wet, and most of the caves around this area are wet. While touring a mile-long cave located south of Millstatt, Lamping spoke about the sinkhole plan and how it is a natural drain for the surface water of southern Illinois. There are about 1,000 caves located in Illinois, whereas Missouri has more than 7,300. Most of those Illinois caves are located just southeast of St. Louis in southern Illinois. Monroe County has about 380 documented caves. St. Clair County has less than 100, and Union County has a little more than 100. Lamping warned that area caves can flood with water quickly. There isn't necessarily a lead-up time when one has this safe window of opportunity to see a gradual rise and know when they need to exit, he said. Instead, it tends to be a wall of water that comes. So this is the last place a person would want to be in the event of a rain. He said, even cave explorers are still cautious about how they approach a trip. They watch the weather closely, and in a cave, like those located in southern Illinois, any chance of rain will cancel their trip, despite all the possible hazards for those properly educated. Cave exploration is generally safe and is a valuable way to learn more about the subterranean resources, he said. Lamping encourages new cavers to seek out experienced cavers and organizations. The National Speleological Society members maintain a list of grottos or caving clubs for each region in a state. Illinois Speleological Survey and Merrimack Valley Grotto are two active area organizations. Safety tips. Make sure you have three sources of light. Have a helmet with a mounted light. Explore with a minimum number of four people. Have a contact on the surface that knows your location and your in and out times. Check the weather beforehand, have permission from landowners to explore the cave, and know about the cave you are entering. As a former spelunker from southern Illinois myself, I can tell you it's a lot of fun going into those small caves. We even caught some bats one time and took them into the high school to show our biology teacher. Only one escaped. Driver cited for cell phone use in two-vehicle crash. Collision at 22nd Street and U.S. 36 injures police officer. By Jalen Cook, Decatur. Police on Tuesday said a 41-year-old man was cited in a two-vehicle crash at North 22nd Street and U.S. 36 that injured a 32-year-old Decatur police officer Monday evening. Lieutenant Shannon Seal said the crash happened at 6:25 p.m. The police SUV, which had two officers inside, was traveling south on 22nd, while the man's 1998 Chevrolet Silverado pickup truck was westbound on U.S. 36, she said. Seal said as the police vehicle attempted to cross the intersection with a green light, the pickup truck ran a red light and collided with the officers. A 56-year-old man witnessed the crash and confirmed what happened to police, she said. Decatur Fire Captain Mike Emmerd said Monday that the injured female officer was taken to HSHS St. Mary's Hospital to be treated for injuries not considered serious. Seal said the officer was a passenger in the police vehicle and is expected to make a full recovery. She said the officer was released from the hospital Monday night and was recovering at home Tuesday. The 26-year-old male officer, who was driving the police SUV, suffered a few burns from the airbag deployment in the crash, but was not treated at the hospital, Seal said. Emmert said the driver of the pickup truck also refused treatment at the scene. Seal said the pickup truck driver admitted to using his cell phone before the crash. He was cited for improper use of an electronic communication device while driving, disobeying a traffic signal, and driving without a valid driver's license, she said. And that's the end of part one of the Wednesday, July 11th edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. This has been Captain Rick reporting. I'll be back with part two after the break.